Okay, it says 7 o'clock up there. We have not heard the bell, but Andrew, would you want to lead us in prayer?
Father in heaven, we come before you now. We are thankful for this time to study from your word. We hope to glean what we can and to make applications. We thank you for the teachers that have prepared for tonight upstairs and with Tommy. We hope that they have good remembrance and that we can have good participation. In Jesus' name, amen.
When we closed last time, we were in Isaiah 22, and we talked about Shebna in verses 15 through 19, how he was trying to hew out a tomb for himself or have a tomb prepared for himself. And also, apparently, one of the things he liked to do is to ride in his chariot, which made him feel important. In verse 18, there your splendid chariots will be, they will be cast into a foreign land where he will die. So he rode his fancy chariots. He prepared a great tomb for himself. He had misused his public office. And as a result from that, he was going to be removed from his position. And Eliakim was going to take his place. So this is in verse 20 of Isaiah 22. Let's look at the text. Then it will come about in that day that I will summon my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your tunic and tie your sash securely about him. Those words are a lot different, secretly and securely. I'll tie your sash securely about him. I will entrust him with your authority, and he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Now, Eliakim is called my servant. My servant. So it's a high, dignified position in the Old Testament. Moses is called that. Prophets are called that. Sometimes you see other characters referred to that way. But he is going to be entrusted with the authority that now belongs to Shebna. It seems like, even before the book ends, when we get to Isaiah 36 and 37, that this man, Eliakim, seems to be in the position that God is prophesying of right here. He will be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. In Genesis 45, verse 10, this describes Joseph's relationship with Egypt. He is a father to them. Genesis 45, 10, and it describes the priest that Micah hired and his relationship to Micah's house and to the tribe of Dan in Judges 17, verse 10, Judges 18, verse 19. That's the word father. He will be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one opens. Now, I don't remember if we had enough time Sunday morning to mention that this statement is made in the book of Revelation. If you remember our sermons to the seven churches in Revelation 3:7, Jesus is described as he who is holy, who is a key, who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one will open. So in Revelation 3:7, Jesus is described in the terms which Eliakim is described in Isaiah 22, verse 22. Now that's amazing to me. So even his appearance in Scripture, his brief appearance, somehow foreshadows Jesus. And apparently this Eliakim is of much superior character than Shebna before him. And God says in verse 23, I'm going to drive him like a peg in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. So Shebna, in contrast to Eliakim, he's going to be driven like a peg, firm place, a peg, you know, that you can hang your coat on, you can hang your clothes on. That's what he will be. But in verse 24, so they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house. Do some of your versions have all the weight of his father's house? Any of your versions have that? Not seeing anybody responding to that. I was thinking that some did. But all the glory of your father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of vessels, from bowls to all the jars. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will give way. It will even break off and fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut off, for the Lord has spoken. Now, what are we to make of that little message? It does seem like Eliakim is of superior character to Shebna, who was condemned in verses 15 through 19. He is spoken of as my servant, and he's going to be a father to the people. He's got great responsibilities in the house of David in verse 22. God drives him like a peg, but ultimately, too much weight is put on that peg, and ultimately, it collapses as well. Now, some have suggested that this is describing his sin of nepotism, family favoritism, because they wanted to hang all the glory of their father's house on this peg. Ultimately, it gave way. That could be it, or it could simply be a statement that even good men and good rulers, if too much weight is put upon them, they can't carry it. There are limitations placed on them. Always, when you have good men, whether in spiritual responsibilities or secular ones, always when you have good men and women in those places, you have limited people in those places. And there is only so much they can do. And ultimately, if given too much responsibility and too much thrown upon them, eventually that peg's going to give way. And so it's a statement that I think that he's going to be a good man, a good person, but ultimately he will have a weight that he is not able to bear as well. Okay. Now, if you don't have any questions that hit you right off on that, let's go to Tyre. Tyre is mentioned in this next section repeatedly. It is the main focus of this section. It is mentioned in this chapter at least six times. Also, Sidon is mentioned several times in this passage, in verse 2, in verse 4, in verse 12. Now, when you think about Tyre and Sidon and their relationships to Israel, what can you think of in the past between Tyre and Sidon and Israel? Positive or negative? Sometimes there may be some positive things too. Can you think about much about those cities, those towns? What do you think of? Mary? You see Mary's hand and Anne Marie's hand. Jezebel. Okay, would Jezebel be a good thing or a bad thing? Well, we answered ourselves. Anne Marie.
The king of Tyre, Hiram, was friends with David.
Okay, king of Tyre has a big, a positive influence with David and Solomon. Particularly, you remember that they provided, the king of Tyre provides the lumber for Solomon to build the temple and Solomon to build the palace. You read about this in 1 Kings chapter 5. Now, everything, Everything we read about Tyre and Sidon and Israel until the times of David and Solomon, till their death, it's all positive. But it's after the time of David and Solomon that we begin to see the negative, like Mary mentioned in 1 Kings 16, verse 31. Jezebel's father was the king of Sidon. He was the king of Sidon, Jezebel's father. And he is a devoted Baal worshiper. His name is Eth Baal, which means Baal is alive. And so there you see a decidedly negative influence that Tyre and Sidon exert in the land of Israel. Just a couple of more things. There's a few more things we could mention, but let's just focus on a couple. In Jeremiah 27, there are several nations that come to Jerusalem to meet with Zedekiah to plot rebellion against Babylon. This is when Jeremiah puts on his neck the yoke that symbolizes that they need to surrender to Babylon. And one of the kings who comes in order to plot rebellion is the king of Tyre. Also, the king of Tyre, the king of Sidon are both among those kings that come and plot rebellion against Israel. A passage that the most extended condemnation of Tyre in the Bible is Ezekiel 26 through 28. Most of that focuses on Tyre. Some of it focuses on Sidon as well. Now, Tyre and Sidon weren't big cities in some ways. What made Tyre significant? What made Tyre a big player in human history, Mary? Okay, access to the sea. Did somebody, Alan? Okay, you want to say the same thing, but it was because of their trade, because of their ships. Notice how frequently when we look at Isaiah 23, notice how frequently there will be references to the sea, references to ships, and particularly in the Old Testament. I skipped you over a second ago, Alan. Jonah called a ship going to where? Tarshish. Okay, other people answered it for you. I'm sorry. Gave you an easy one. I know you knew it. But ships of Tarshish played a big part in the ancient world. And this text will mention the ships of Tarshish quite a bit. But Tyre became a significant player in world history because of the sea trade. Now, let's read some of these verses. Let's read verses 1 through 14. Let's pick out some of that. The oracle concerning Tyre. Well, O ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is destroyed without inhabitant or harbor. It is reported to them from the land of Cyprus. Be silent, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon. Your messengers crossed the sea and were on many waters, the grain of the Nile. Some of your versions may have Sihor. The harvest of the river was her revenue. She was the market of the nations. Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I have neither travailed nor given birth. I have neither brought up young men nor reared virgins. When the report reaches Egypt, they will be in anguish at the report of Tarshish. Pass over to Tarshish. Well, O inhabitant of the coastland, is this your jubilant city whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places. Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored men of the earth? The Lord of hosts has planned it to defile the pride of all her beauty, to despise all the honored of the earth. Overflow her land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more restraint. He has stretched his hand out over the sea. He has made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Canaan to demolish its stronghold. He has said, "You shall exult no more, O crushed virgin, daughter of Sidon. They arise, pass over to Cyprus. Even there you will find no rest. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans, that is the people which was not Assyria, appointed for the desert creatures. They erected their siege towers. They stripped its palaces. They made it a ruin. Well, O ships of Tarshish, for your stronghold is destroyed." So, Tyre, Sidon, and I hope you were noticing how frequently you see references to sea, you see references to ships of Tarshish, how just those things are constantly coming up in the description here. But Tyre and Sidon became trade centers of the world. They had the ships that carried goods in many directions and brought back goods from all kinds of places. And so she is described in verse 3, she is described as the market of the nations, the market of the nations. She was a great trading partner. When we were on Revelation 18, and Revelation 18 lamented the fall of Babylon the Great. Babylon is fallen, and the people were grieving. A lot of the description of Babylon's fall is built on the description of the fall of Tyre in Ezekiel 37. You remember in Revelation 18, do you remember there who was wailing the fall of Babylon? Remember, it was the merchants who were wailing her fall. It was the shipmasters who were wailing her fall. Much of the description of the fall of Babylon is built on the picture of the fall of Tyre in Ezekiel 27. But in this text, it is a, what are some other phrases that you see throughout this section that stress the exalted position that Tyre had? We already pointed out that she was a market of the nations in verse 3. Did you see other expressions that indicated her significance, her prestige, her power? Alan?
Her pompous pride of all her glory.
Okay, which verse was that?
That's in verse 9.
Okay. Yes, as it's talking about her fall, the pride of all beauty, or the pride of all her glory.
Her strongholds.
Okay, strongholds. Those are words applied. Lloyd?
Bestower of crowns in verse 8.
Okay, bestower of crowns. We use this term sometimes that somebody's a kingmaker. Often people in that position, they're not the one who could be the visible face of an organization. But it's only with their blessings that someone rises to the top. We understand that kind of concept. And that's what's said here about Tyre. It is a bestower of crowns. It refers to all her beauty and all her pride and all her glory. And so in verses 8 and 9, as Lloyd and Alan point out. Another thing that's pointed out, anyone else have anything? One of the things that's pointed out is the antiquity of the city in verse 7, whose origin is from antiquity. Herodotus was to say a few centuries after this that the priest at Tyre claimed that it had been built 2,300 years earlier. And Josephus states that Tyre was founded long before Solomon built the Jerusalem temple. Josephus doesn't place it as far back as Herodotus does, but both of them state that this was an ancient city, and this was an ancient city that used to colonize distant places. And so all of these things are said about the significance of the city and the role that it played. But who brings about Tyre's demise? Who brings about Tyre's demise? Now, there's an easy question. Who brings that out? Who? Okay, the Lord of hosts. Yes, in verse 8 and 9, we see that. In verse 11, we see that. That God is the one who is bringing about her destruction. In verse 11, he stretched out his hand over the sea. He has made the kingdoms tremble. Remember, we have seen that picture of God's judgment about his hand is still outstretched, particularly in Isaiah 9 and the first of Isaiah 10. And here we see that as well, that here God's hand is stretched out, not like it was in 9 and 10 against his people, but here it is stretched out against Tyre. Now, I'm sure that I am overlooking some really important things in verses 1 through 14. What do you have questions about? What do you have things, what do you have that you'd like to ask about? Anything? Nina? Yes. Tyre and Sidon were both apparently assigned to Asher. And you find that in Joshua 19, I think it's 28 and 29 that you see that. In 28, among those cities, it says Ebron that were assigned to Asher, Ebron, Rehob, Hammon, Cana, as far as Great Sidon, the border turned to Ramah, to the fortified city of Tyre. So yes, it doesn't seem like, Nina, that Israel's territory ever stretched that far. But it does seem to have been assigned to the tribe of Asher, yes. And that is a good point to make. And thank you. That's one of the points I overlooked. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes, what was that? It called it a fortified city. And that's a statement along the lines of what verse 7 in this text was making, that it is a city from antiquity. By the time this city was conquered in the days of Joshua and Jericho, or the time this area was conquered, it was already a well-fortified city. So it points to it's a city from antiquity. It's had a long history. It's been around for a long, long time. What else, Tony? Okay.
Instead of just calling them the Babylonians like he has in a previous couple chapters.
Yes.
Why call them the Chaldeans? Why say this is the place that the Assyrians set up for wild beasts and a people this people which was not.
Okay. Okay. Tony was asking, if you couldn't hear the first part about verse 13, Let me just read it from the New American Standard again. It says, behold, the land of the Chaldeans, that is the people which was not Assyrian appointed, Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. They erected their siege towers. They stripped its palaces. They made it a ruin. A couple of different views I saw on that passage that Tony asked about. One is that this is telling us that the Chaldeans are the ones, or the Babylonians, and I don't know that there's a big significance in him using that term versus Babylon, but some say, well, this is saying that the Chaldeans or the Babylonians are going to be the one ultimately to bring this judgment. Nebuchadnezzar did attack the city of Tyre for 13 years. That is alluded to in the book of Ezekiel. That's from about 587 to 574, somewhere in those dates. So some think that's the destruction he's talking about. I tend to think that what he's saying is at this time, this land of the Chaldeans, Babylon, had probably been devastated by an Assyrian invasion, and he's telling Tyre the same's going to happen to them. Those are, I think, the two big possibilities. One, that Babylon's going to be the destroyer, or that one, you're going to be destroyed like Babylon. Okay.
Like, I didn't know because maybe they have prison of power in yet.
Yeah.
So maybe he's just saying, well, they're not now, but they will be.
It could be. It could be. And particularly if you take the view that they're going to be the destroyer. If you take the view that they are the destroyed, statement that they are not is a good statement to say, listen, you're going to be like them. Yeah. You're going to be judged. Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There are a lot of connections.
Not just general prophetic terms, but just things that only we see in Revelation.
Okay. Okay, yes, it that is a good point to see the interconnectedness of it all. Okay, I'm hesitant to do this. Okay, do you know what that is? What is that? The coastland of Tyre. Duh, of course it is. You can't recognize that, you know. It's the coastland of Tyre. So here's Tyre here. There is also an island a little bit offshore that was Tyre, too. And so sometimes this city, Tyre, suffered severely. And Nebuchadnezzar, when he attacked it, that we mentioned earlier, when he attacked this city for 13 years, he tried to capture that island. And those people just know they're not going to get captured because the island surrounds them everywhere and nobody's going to come get them. Is that right? Until who? Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great, again, the people were confident in the days of Alexander, and this is past New Testament time, so or past Old Testament time. But Alexander had his men start throwing, I don't know this is the exact statement, but this is the equivalent of like throwing bricks in the sea until they eventually built up a road and they went out and destroyed Tyre. And but in their history, that island of Tyre was never controlled until the time of Alexander. The city inland often suffered severely, but the island city was not taken. Now, let's look at verses 15 through 18. It will come about in that day that Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years. like the days of one king. At the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre, as in the song of the harlot, take your harp, walk about your city, O forgotten harlot, pluck the strings skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered. It will come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre, that she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms on the face of the earth. And by the way, that's Revelation kind of language. Her gain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. It will not be stored up or hoarded, but her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord. Okay, this is not the main point. We don't want to miss sight of the main point. We're going to build up to it. But notice the references to 70 years twice in verse 15 and then in verse 17. 70 years. Now you read 70 years in the Bible, in the Old Testament. There are a couple of places your mind could quickly go. Where are they? Babylonian captivity is said to last by Jeremiah 70 years. That's one. That's when, and that's really big. What was another time 70 years is used in a passage that we usually remember? The days of a man's life are 70 by reason of strength, 80, then they're soon cut off and they fly away. That's from Psalm 90. But Babylonian captivity, there are a couple of places that it's said to last 70 years. In Jeremiah 25, 11 and 12, Jeremiah 29 and verse 10, 70 years. Now, I can remember one time I was in a meeting, and it was, I was teaching the Sunday morning Bible class, and I said Babylonian captivity lasted from 605 to 539 B.C. And I can remember this one good brother questioned me privately. He says, that's not 70 years. And you know, older Bible, older Old Testament introductions, a lot of times would say 606 to 536 to try to make that an exact 70 years. But there are a couple of things. First of all, it could be that this is more generalized and that is about 70 years. It could be, too, that they counted those 70 years not from how long they were in captivity, but from how long they were without the temple. Solomon's temple was destroyed about 587, and it was rebuilt about 516. That may be the 70 years. There's a passage in Zechariah 1 that may indicate that. Now, what does it have to do with anything? The point I'm making, 70 years too, may be kind of a figurative description in some places of just a long time, because for 70 years, Tyre's going to be forgotten. 70 years, emphasized three times in the text. Maybe we're to see this as just kind of a conventional term for nations being carried away in captivity or nations experiencing some great demise for a long period of time. But I don't want you to get lost in that, and forgive me if I did that in my teaching, because I don't want you to get lost in that. I want you to understand the main point. The main point, this city is described as a harlot. Now that's a description often applied to Jerusalem. In Isaiah 1, it was applied to them. It is applied sometimes to cities like Assyria, but here it's applied to Tyre. They're a harlot, and they're going to suffer for all this time, these 70 years. And they're not going to learn anything. from it. That's what verse 18 emphasizes. Or verse 17, the latter middle part of verse 17, she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms of the earth. After those 70 years are up, she can't wait to resume her sinful ways. But all her wealth and all that she gains by her wheeling and dealing among the nations will ultimately all flow to God and to His people. That's something that's going to become more prominent at the end of Isaiah. And another point we also see at the end of the book of Revelation. In verse 18, her gain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. And her gain will be sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of God, presence of the Lord. But I find that little section at the end especially interesting. A question about it, a thought about it. What I want to try to do here in the last 15 minutes of class, what are we to learn from this whole section? This is a part of Isaiah that is hard sometimes to study, hard to do personal reading on. It's hard to teach and communicate because it can seem very irrelevant to us on our careful reading. If we don't read it carefully, if we don't think about it. But in this section, Isaiah 13 through 23, what have been some themes that keep coming up? What are some ideas that kept coming up in this section? Now, I won't tell you, Alan, what do you got? Pride is something. Yes, that's it's with my point four, Alan. So you're quick, you're ahead of me. First point I was going to make, and I think this is probably really first dimension first. The Lord rules all these nations. That's stressed in so many ways. And what we saw tonight, it was really stressed here about Tyre in verses 8 and 9. Look again at those verses. Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored men of earth? The Lord of hosts has planned it to defile the pride of all beauty. In verse 11, he stretched out his hand over the sea. He has made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Canaan to demolish its strongholds. The Lord is in control of the nations. Go back to chapter 14. Chapter 14, remember there was a short section from verses 24 through 27 that mentioned Assyria. Assyria. And God says in verse 4, the Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely just as I have intended, so it has happened. Just as I have planned, so it shall stand. The Lord of hosts brings us about. Verse 26 and 27, this is a plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against the nations. For the Lord of hosts has planned it. Who can frustrate it? He has stretched out his hand. Who can turn it back? Over and over again. Now, that's just a couple of examples. We could multiply those examples many times over, and I have other examples in the notes. If you want me to post this part of this, I could do that. But the Lord rules the nations. The Lord rules the nations. And that is being stressed, whether it is little Israel and Judah, whether it is big Assyria, whether it is commercial Tyre, God rules all these places. He is ruler of the kingdoms of men. It is amazing that of all these nations, here, 3,000 years, almost 3,000 years later, we are studying about the religion of basically a small third world country in Judah, because their God is different than all other gods. Now, a couple of these points, I think, have been also obvious, but one, the wicked will not escape judgment. The wicked will not escape judgment. This has been amply made. This point has been really any time that God describes judgment coming on a people, it can be said it's a lesson that wickedness will not escape. But another point, this judgment on the wicked is for the benefit of God's people. It is for the benefit of God's people. Remember back in 14, 1 and 2, as the Bible was describing judgment on Babylon, it said in 14, 1 and 2, when the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and choose Israel and settle them in his own, in their own land. When God will have compassion on Jacob, God's judgment of the wicked of the earth is a statement of mercy to his own people. Now, four, let's put it as a question. What are the reasons? What are the reasons for judgment on the nations? What are the reasons for judgment on the nation? Now, Alan, you mentioned my first point under this heading just a moment ago. What did you give us a reason? Pride. Pride. In several of the verses I have down, I have 13, 11, 14, 12 through 15. You remember how the king of Babylon exalted himself to the throne of God, claiming to be God. It was true of the king of, it was true of Moab, and it was true of Tyre as well. So that is one reason for judgment, the pride of these nations, not recognizing their dependence upon God. What are other reasons through the text that we have seen judgment come? A couple of big ones, Katrina. Idolatry is a big point. Idolatry, pride, idolatry. To show their gods were empty and powerless. We saw that with Moab in 15:2 and in 16 verse 12. In that section that's given about Ephraim and Israel in 17 verses 6 through 10, they will learn not to look to the idols that they have made, but put their trust in God. The idols of Egypt tremble at the Lord's presence in 19:1 and 19:3. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great and her idols in 21 verse 9. So they are judged for pride. They are judged for idolatry. What is another reason given in these sections that God is bringing judgment? Tiffany? Cruelty? Their cruelty, yes. Their mistreatment? Their mistreatment of God's people? Yes. Now, I didn't write down all the verses for that. But yes, sometimes their cruelty, their mistreatment of God's people, this is something that plays a key role in these judgment on the nation section throughout the Bible, really. The one other that I wrote down some verses for is, I think it shows the people the futility of putting their trust in these nations, because these nations are going to fall. These nations are going to fall too. Why would Judah not listen to Isaiah the prophet? Well, he's telling them, don't make an alliance with Egypt. Don't make an alliance with Aram or Israel. Don't do that at all. Part of the thing that is being shown is the futility, the emptiness of trusting in his places. And remember when we were dealt with chapter 20, verses 3 through 6? And I guess I shouldn't write on the board because it's not legible at that point. But 23 through 6, God is going to show that putting your trust in Egypt and Cush is absolutely hopeless. But I want to tell you a couple of other things. Let's see if we can get to these quickly. Now, I know this would be something that would be hard to convince a lot of people of. But one of the things we have seen throughout this, and this is point five, God's love for the nations. Particularly, that point was made in 15:5, in 16:9 and 10. I think it was 21, verse 3 and 4. God loves these nations. And that ties with the last point. The last point that I put, and this is my list, and this could be improved on. But in my list, my last point is God is doing this to turn the nations back to Him. What is God's ultimate purpose in judging these nations? If these nations have anyone, a remnant, that can turn back, that will listen, God is seeking to do that. We saw that, look at 14 and, excuse me, in 16, verse 5. You remember that it was said to Moab, a throne will be established in loving kindness, and a judge will sit in faithfulness in the tent of David. Moreover, he will seek justice and be prompt in righteousness. Remember that picture in 19 verses 18 through 25 of this highway that connects Egypt and Assyria, and they run through the land of Israel, and they all worship God together. God always had a big picture plan for all nations. He called Abraham with the purpose of reaching all nations for him. And even in his judgment on these nations for their mistreatment of God's people, judgment on them because of their pride and idolatry, in all these judgments, God was trying to get the people, any that would have ears to hear and a heart to learn, to understand that they need to follow Him and to be His people and to have Him as their God. Okay. As our time unwinds on this section, do you have any last questions, specifically about tonight, what we've covered either in chapter 22 and 23, or the big kind of the overview of the big picture thing of the whole section? Anything?
Nations are made up of people. This is what God expects of us. We'll boil it down.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. These are eternal lessons that we can learn from this. I mean, we might look back and say, 700 BC, Moab, they are nothing. Why would they be proud? Sometimes I look at myself and what little I've done, and I think, why would you ever have a problem with pride? You haven't done anything to be proud about. And yet, we do wrestle with that, don't we? We do wrestle, and a lot of the picture of pride is just putting ourselves at the center and pushing God to the outskirts of our life. But I think you're exactly right, Tiffany, that this is a very relevant lesson when we start to reflect upon it and take it into consideration for our own life. Now, it's the end of February, which means that at another month, we've got a new verse that's coming. But right now, let's try to quote our last two in 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9. And I've forgotten how it started. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became that so that you through his poverty. Okay, very good. Galatians 2:20. I am crucified with Christ. Keep going. Christ lives in me. In the life I live in the flesh, okay, sound like everybody was on the same page, best I could tell. but Lord willing, have another verse coming Sunday. Let's keep trying to remember those. Thank you.